Today, the topic is that of personality and intelligence and those things that have to do with the making up of a balanced personality and intelligence. And I'd like to start off by talking about something that I find rather distressing and have for a number of years. And that has to do with toys. There is a book that just came into my hand called Turmoil in the Toy Box by a man named Phil Phillips. And when I looked at his picture, I thought, well, he is so young looking, I'm sure that he wouldn't have anything very substantive to teach us. But he really does. He has had a lot of experience, and I'd just like to read a few of the things that he has written. It says, by the time the child is a teen, unless his parents have instilled Christian values into him, he will have more knowledge of the occult than he will have of God. I believe that to be a fact. I believe that in the world that we live in today, we are teaching the occult right and left with lots of different things that we have not suspected that we were teaching the occult. And all manner of images, cartoons and toys and rock music and movies and TV, it's everywhere these days. Newspapers, the horoscope, there are many people who will not start their day off without reading their horoscope. Here is another item. Adults wanting to promote a peaceful society should prohibit war toys. Otherwise, children might learn to believe that all problems are solved through violence, aggression, and conquering a victim. So that's another thing that I think that parents should watch out for. Children are not born knowing how to play. They have to be taught how to play. You have to teach a child how to play just as you teach him everything else. His facial expressions, his voice inflection, his pitch and timbre and tone, all of this has to be taught to the child. And parents should set aside time to be with the children to teach them that. Especially this falls on the mother. The mother should become aware of the fact that her children are uneducated and they are also heathen. They're born that way. And on the blank tablets of their minds, she can inscribe many wonderful principles. I remember the first time that this came to my attention. In fact, it came to my attention in this very room that we're sitting in. Sister Marie McClure and her husband, Brother McClure, taught classes to us in child guidance and marriage and the home and child rearing. And for the first time, it really came to my attention that children are in need of being taught everything. They need to be taught how to choose their companions. For a long time, they do not know how to choose their companions. And their playmates should be chosen for them, what playmates they are allowed to have. You should not feel that your children need large numbers of playmates. A child is far more likely to be a leader if his playmates are adults than if his playmates are children. And I have seen an example of that this week. A young lad who is being homeschooled by his mother. And I don't know if she would want me to reveal who she is, but I saw on several instances her son, who is being homeschooled, acting in a leadership, a supervisory role for other children, naturally doing so just because of the way that he has been trained. And so I would like to encourage parents to understand that they may give their children leadership capabilities by being their companion. And I'll have a little more to say about that when I talk about birth order and the type of home that a child is born into. The parent who gets down on the floor to play with a child on Christmas is doing something that will be seldom repeated throughout the rest of the year. On the other hand, many parents believe one of the main purposes of toys is to ensure that children can occupy themselves without demanding a great deal of the parent's time. Now, what he is talking about here is substitution. He feels, and I do too, that children should be more in the companionship of their parents than in the companionship of any kind of surrogate parent. whether it be television or a babysitter or toys or pets or whatever. And I'll have more to say about that in just a little bit. Now, cartoons are, in our day, programming children so that they know how to believe and how to act and even how to think, what their intelligence is. We're really seeing quite a lot in the way of programming by cartoons, cartoons on television and also cartoons in the comics and the like. Such things as Bugs Bunny and Flintstones, Cabbage Patch, Kids Chewable Vitamins, and Toy and Hobby World. All of these advertised by the use of those things that, and as well as the cereal industry and the toy industry, the sweets industry, pharmaceutical companies, these are all advertising by means of cartoons these days. And I think that it would be really well if we totally eliminated television from our children. And if not total, then so nearly total that it would be a very minor part of what children were ever exposed to. By minor part, I mean something on the order of a few minutes per year, rather than even a few minutes per day. Now, I'd like to talk about the unicorn. Phil Phillips talks about the unicorn symbol in this book, Turmoil in the Toy Box. The unicorn is a symbol of the Antichrist, which the prophet Daniel described in his vision as the little horn which rises in the midst of ten horns. I remember one time I went to a boarding school, a high school, and I was in the girls' dorm. It happened to be a holiday season, so all the students were home, but all their things were still in the dormitory. One of the things that struck me was the number of unicorns that I saw. The little pulleys for the window shades were unicorns. Lamps were unicorns. Beds had designs on them of unicorns. Pictures, diagrams on the wall of unicorns, embroidered things of unicorns. I was absolutely astounded. Until that time, I had not been aware that the unicorn was a sort of a craze amongst the young people. But I would like to point out that any kind of grotesque image that has a pagan connotation about it is injurious to the spirituality of our children and should not be allowed in our homes, nor should the children be allowed to have these in their rooms when they go away to school. So I feel that we should be much more careful about these things than we have been. The rainbow is a symbol representing the New Age movement. I didn't know that until I read this, but here is something that this biblical symbol, naturally, we would expect that biblical symbols would be picked up by the occult and put into as they are taken up in this way, that they would be put in a position where they would represent something that was para-religious, so that our children would learn that was just to the side of religion. You can see how it would be well if we had this kind of thing If you wanted to subvert the religion of someone, the best thing to do would be to make them to have a religion that was as near to what they have as you could make it, and yet was not the right thing. It was a very good counterfeit. That's what these things are, very good counterfeits. He gives a group of definitions, a sort of a glossary of terms. He-Man. Who is He-Man, do you know? The most powerful man in the universe. Yes, I was amazed. Man-E-Faces. He's a heroic human, a robot, a monster. Zoar, a fighting falcon. Are you familiar with all these? Well, these were all new to me. I haven't watched television in about 22 years, and these were all new terms to me. I was all the more glad about the day when we got rid of television in our home. It was a great day. Then he shows a lot of cartoons here, just a bunch of them. Here is one that I find particularly objectionable. Look at this ugly picture. When I was a little girl, when we wanted dolls or teddy bears or something like that, we wanted things that were beautiful. These grotesque things that you see these days, they're not pretty at all. I can't imagine a child really enjoying these things. But look at the expressions on the faces. This is an actual photograph by this grotesque toy, actual photograph of the boys and girls who are looking at these things. And look at this eyeball here, this bare eyeball. Call it what? Yes, no wonder parents call their children monsters anymore. They literally are. They have become the monsters that they view. And the ugly faces on these children's faces in the photographs, I find that quite objectionable. When we put an expression on the face, the heart automatically takes on that same expression. Are you aware of the studies in psychology that show that the type of expression that a person puts on the face is very likely to be the kind of emotion that the person will begin to have? So if you want to have a good emotion, put that emotion on your face, and it will turn out to be prophetic almost as to what happens in your heart. Question is? Yes. Is this why the Indians used to faint themselves when they went on the warpath? And indeed it was, and why they would go through various gyrations. And it is indeed. I remember when I used to be in competitive sports, we were taught to put a certain set on the jaw and a determination on the face, so that you would intimidate your opponents to some degree, and also the precision with which you went about your various exercises, all of that was intimidating. And if you couldn't beat them by sheer skill, you did it by a combination of skill and imagery that you projected from the face. I would like to recommend this. I have not read it, but I have scanned through it a good bit. It's called Turmoil in the Toy Box, and I'd like to recommend that parents might like to take a look at this. It certainly did impress me as I thumbed through it. Now, the next thing that I would like to talk with you about is that of the personality. The personality is the sum total of that we recognize as being that we project. And I'm sure that you have heard of the type A personality. Type A personality is a kind of hard-driving executive personality that we have thought of as having an early heart attack or an early stroke, a man who has high blood pressure, or a woman who develops septic ulcers and gets high blood pressure and dies early of a stroke. Well, the type A personality, we're now learning, is not only the hard-driving executive, but it is also a large number of other people, too. You do not have to be a successful executive to have a type A personality. A lot of people have it. And I will define the type A personality for you in just a little bit. But let me just give you some of the characteristics of the type A personality. They shift more often and more intensely in response to a challenge. In other words, they take it from several different angles, several times. They approach it many different times. And in doing so, there is an increase in their blood pressure and pulse, and their norepinephrine and epinephrine levels and catecholamine levels go up in the blood. These are all stress hormones. Now, the immune system has very similar functions to the functions of the brain. The function of the immune system is, of course, to assist us in fighting germs and to assist the body to make a certain armamentarium that will enable the person to instantly recognize and defend itself against germs. The immune system also eliminates malignant cells when they are first born. The immune system may also have to do with keeping us from eating on ourselves, the so-called autoimmune disorders like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and dermatomyositis and the like. Even schizophrenia is felt by many to be intimately related with the immune system. It's an interesting thing that people who get rheumatoid arthritis almost never get schizophrenia. Almost never. It is vanishingly rare. Maybe the having of rheumatoid arthritis gives a person a sort of an immunity against schizophrenia. That, of course, has not been worked out very well. We don't even know what schizophrenia is, nor do we know what rheumatoid arthritis is. But that it involves that both of them involve the immune system is apparent at this point in our understanding of these diseases. Now, psychological processes, especially stress on the immune system, is undergoing a great deal of research these days, and I believe that we may have something to turn out of this research in the next 10 years. We certainly hope so. Now, so far as grief is concerned, grief affects the immune system. If a person is still grieving after about 10 weeks from the death of a spouse, there is a tenfold greater likelihood that that person will have some kind of life-threatening disease within the next year. These things are controlled by the immune system. So, grieving should come to an end. We must put grieving from the mind. And while the life may never be the same again after the death of a spouse, one must do what is necessary to bring oneself out of grief. The brain can keep us healthy, even in a complex and heterogeneous society, if we allow its millions of regulatory processes to go on unhampered. Now, the type A personality begins in early childhood, probably among the earliest things that develop in childhood. Probably a predisposition to develop the type A personality plus the influence of parental control, those two things together, probably make it so that the type A personality is born. These children and adolescents show psychological and physical signposts that identify them as the type A personality. They often have sleep disturbances. They often have more colds and sore throats, headaches, flus, and allergies than other children. These children have insecurity in their homes. They grow up to have insecurities in their marriages. Many a type A personality will require repeated reassurances of the love of the spouse, even when it would be obvious if they sat down and thought about the matter that the spouse really loved them, even adored them. And yet they require repeated assurances that the person is loved because of the insecurities that they have, because of their type A personality. They should come to grips with themselves on this. They should recognize that they have that propensity and simply determine that they are not going to exhibit that kind of behavior. Type A personalities have as many friends as type B personalities and others, just as many social contacts. They're able to maintain them just as well, but they worry a great deal over their friendships. They worry about whether their friends love them and approve of them and consider them to be worthy friends. Type A children also report that they are angrier more often and for longer periods of time, and that they are more explosive than our type B's or even low type A's. The parents of type A boys say that they criticize their son's failures more often than parents of type B say that they criticize their boys. Fathers of type A boys are more likely to use physical punishment in response to their son's misbehavior than fathers of type B. Type A behavior is more than an isolated syndrome. It's that many people have when they have a sense of necessity for high achievement and at the same time feel that a certain amount of coercion or destructive behavior is necessary in order to control other people. I feel that if we can recognize that we are type A personalities with insecurity, with a decided bent toward controlling children and other people through more harsh measures, that we can be healed from the type A personality. And we need not have a heart attack early in life, nor need we go around all the time with adrenaline and noradrenaline and catecholamines and other stress hormones floating in the bloodstream because of our maladjustment. It is possible to be healed from psychological maladjustments or personality maladjustments. Now let's talk about some of the mechanisms of adjustment of the personality. One thing is that of sublimation. Sublimation is that one puts under one's real desire by doing something else. Now I've given you the example here that if you want to chop off somebody's head, what did I tell you it would be better for you to do? Go to the wood pile and take the axe and chop some wood. If you want to eat some forbidden food, then make a lunch for somebody and take that lunch to them. Don't feel embarrassed to do so. It is biblical. We are told that when we minister to the poor, that our health will do what? Spring forth speedily. Absolutely. And so, if you are battling with bulimia, allow that to be the way that you handle the matter with food. Prepare 1,800 plates if you need to, and I have had enough, I have had patients who have eaten that much in the course of a month. Just an enormous amount of food. I had one young lady who ate so much that she said her abdomen would come out to her knees. One time I saw her almost in that position. It was a most disabling problem. She was a nurse and could not work. She could not stay out of the, what do you call the place there where you make up the medicines? No, on the ward. The medicine room. She couldn't stay out of the medicine room where there was a refrigerator and she had things that she had back there, her lunch, and sacks of groceries. And she would go back there and eat those things, and it was disabling. She could not do her work because of doing that. Yes, that's called bulimia. Now, for such a person, no matter how mild your case may be, we should be able to eat a proper quantity of food and then stop eating. And if we cannot do that, then what we should do is to prepare a plate of food and give it away to someone who is needy or someone who is a shut-in, whether they need it or not. They may be quite wealthy, but take it to them anyway. And if they simply give it to their puppies out on the back porch, that's much better than for you to take it yourself. And the generous impulse that you have, I guarantee, will be to you a barrier against bulimia of a small degree. Every time you do such an activity, it will assist you to some degree. Now, the second mechanism of adjustment of the personality that we try is that of rationalization. Now, this kind of thing is giving a good reason rather than the real reason for something. A reason that you think will make you look good or will protect your privacy or some other things. And it's not entirely bad to say when you are protecting the intimacy of the family to make some... You do not have to be like the little boy who reveals even intimate details of what goes on in the household. You can be a little more private than that. But on the other hand, we should not be constantly rationalizing what we do or giving those good reasons for things that we have done to escape the necessity of some kind of self-reproach or condemnation of associates. Now, often, rationalization can take two forms. One is the sour grapes form. You're all familiar with that, where we try to convince ourselves or others that we don't really like, we don't really even respect that we actually keenly desire. Now, to give you an example, a young girl who wants to marry a certain young man will say about him certain derogatory things to convince herself and others that she doesn't really want to marry that young man. Now, another type of adjustment that we make in the rationalization type is that of the sweet lemon. That is, we try to make ourselves content with that we really don't like by praising it. Now, you can see that with both of these, there is room for doing that kind of thing. It would be well if we would use that kind of thing to content ourselves with what absolutely cannot be changed. To give you an example, you might say that my old car that has a stick shift, I prefer it much over the newfangled kinds that have automatic shift, because naturally you have more control over your car if you have a stick shift, and besides that, it burns less gasoline. So in this way, you can content yourself with those things that you must content yourself with. At any rate, rationalization arises from a need to defend or account for something that you're not certain is going to be accepted by everybody. Now, the next mechanism of adjustment of the personality is that of identification. We will identify with somebody or something in order that we might make ourselves feel better in our own eyes. This is the sort of name-calling or name-dropping type of thing that you will often find when Reagan and I went golfing last year, some other little thing of this nature that might make me feel better in my own eyes. This is the thing of identification. Now, for the Christian, there is a form of identification that we are commanded to do, and that is, by beholding, we become changed. We look at Christ and become changed in His image. It does indeed do something to our own sense of self-worth by that kind of identification. No human being is worthy of our identifying with that human being. And so if we have the tendency to do name dropping, we should stop that kind of thing. Question?
About rationalization.
Rationalization?
Do you think it's wrong, like if being a disaster happened to you, you guys used to look at it as the purpose in that? Do you think the people are trying to reason that?
All right. The question is, if you have a disaster of some kind and you try to stop thinking about it, is that a wrong thing? And the answer is no. You actually should stop thinking about any kind of disaster or disgrace or financial reverse. Paul gives us the biblical principle on that, forgetting those things which are behind and pressing forward to the mark which is ahead. And we must always do that. There isn't a one of us but must say, well, that was poor judgment, or I have been struck by disaster in this area. My losses have been heavy in this particular thing. We must turn from that and go straight ahead, making certain that we have no regrets for the past. The only thing that we should have as a regret is that we have dishonored the Lord with the past. But then we must put all of that, our past does not belong to us anymore, does it? It now belongs to the Lord. It is His. Because of the fact that the past does not belong to us, we can see how carefully we need to walk in the future. Once we have passed through the present, we then do not own what is in the past. Now, the next mechanism is projection. By this mechanism, we escape from our shortcomings by picking out a scapegoat. We usually criticize that scapegoat. We may feel that the scapegoat is entirely wanting in virtues. We actually want those very virtues that we are criticizing that person for. Now, if you come to understand this mechanism of projection, it will help you to never criticize. Never criticize. All right, let's just give an example. Mrs. James is such a terrible housekeeper. Why, I went over to her house one afternoon, and you would not believe the clutter that was in her living room. What I am doing when I do that kind of thing is projecting my own desire for orderliness myself, and failure to achieve it according to the way that I would like to, and therefore I criticize someone else for being disorderly. That's projection. That's right. Left your sink full of dirty dishes when you went to see Mrs. James.
What about in regards to a husband, the tendency for a wife to be analytical or critical or...
All right. Let's just take a word to deal with our mates right here in this way.
Because, you know, if you know not to, but you find yourself bound to, that's...
Yes. There is no question but that the Lord puts people together because they need one another.
Amen.
They need the balancing of one another. Now, if we will look for what God has put us together for, but look at it toward what it means in correcting me. I have been put with my husband because my sharp traits of character here and here and here need to be ground off. Not the Lord put me with him because I want you to know he really needs polishing. If we look at things in that way, often God can help us to have a very happy life together. Now, this should not make us neglect our duty toward one another. And there are times when we need to sit down. Honey, our bank balance didn't balance again this month. And would you sit down with me and let's decide where. Let's look at all of our expenditures and see what was necessary for us to spend and what was not necessary. Let's just look here. Now, the thing that I see that looms out the biggest is the motor for the boat that you bought. Now, it's not wrong to do that kind of thing. You may need to at times. And if you happen to be the one who has the best control over the purse strings, you should do that often. Now, let me ask you something. Should you simply take control of the purse strings and that's the end of that? If so, he or she will never learn, will they? I know a family in which the father was an excellent bookkeeper. That was his job. That was his profession, was bookkeeping. He would not allow his wife to keep her own earnings. What do you think of that kind of system? Well, I think that it's a basic human right. Type A insecurity. I think it is a basic human right to be able to, and you have the right to decide what happens to your own earnings. Now, let's pose this kind of problem. He works and she works. They both get a salary. She takes her money and does with it what she pleases. And he pays all the bills, buys the children's clothes, pays their tuition, gets... Is that fair and equitable? No, I don't think that is either. If we have the attitude of total communal living, I think that's far better than either one taking the position of being the manager. Now, let's say that one person really does not enjoy at all being bookkeeper and says, honey, would you just take care of the books? You just balance everything. I think he should say, well, here, I'm going to give you a certain budget every month. I'll just write the check. You put this in your account. And then I will audit it once a month and help you to learn how to do it yourself. I would think that that would be a better thing than for him just to take over everything, pay all the bills and do all everything. If she has a problem in this area in not being able to handle money. In fact, it seems to me a much better way to do it. If there is one who cannot handle money, does not know how, let that one learn how to handle money by having to handle the money, the family's finances, with the assistance of the one who does know how to handle it. Statement was made in this day, neither one knows how. And that's a lot of that. There's a lot to be said in that. Now back. Yes, there are some women who do not want to do that. They should not be allowed to get by with it, though, I think, because every woman in the age that we live in needs to know something about bookkeeping and banking and tax laws and all of this kind of thing. So that for this kind of thing, we need to have a judicious development of the entire personality and character through the experiences that we have with life. Now let me just review what this personality adjustment is, and that it is projection. That's what we're studying right now, projection, where we project onto someone else the lack of virtues that we ourselves have, and we would like to have those virtues, we do not have them. Now let's take the thing of transference. Transference is a mechanism that you will often see in our day. I see it with pets, with toys, with work, with the house. I see it in many different areas that a person transfers the affection that is due to one person to an object or a thing or another person. I see men going out to the bar, leaving wife and children at home, and they're drinking with their cronies. Often, people whose intellectual abilities are far below the level of the wife and children which they left at home. I see also a mother who has cats or dogs that she showers affection on when her children are left without affection, or much more frequently, husband. I also see children who are showered with affection to the point that they are spoiled while husband does not have his proper share of mother's affection and time and attention. This is called transference. In our day, it seems to me that pets fill this role for many people who are childless. They surround themselves with pets and spend hours each day grooming and feeding and caring for and loving and walking them, when acts of charity that should be done left undone. People who are dying in their very midst do not have their attention, nor do they have any time for them. This mechanism is called transference. All right, the underlying root for this mechanism is what the question is. It can be multiple. It can be that the person is shy, basically, and doesn't want to get out into society and would much rather have a house full of 19 cats than just to make friends with one's neighbors. Also, I often find that these kinds of individual have difficulty getting along with people that they work with. They should put forth the same effort to get along with people that they put into taking care of their animals. I'm taking a good bit too much time on this part. I need to really race on to some other things. We have a long way to go and not that much time. So I know that many of you have questions. If you would write them down now, we may have time at the end. There is another kind of adjustment, a regression. This kind of thing we find in people who regress to an age below them. In my experience, this happens often when a matter of sexuality is involved, that a person will, that a lady who should be in the dignity of her maturation regresses to a juvenile level because of some conflict in sexuality or a desire to be noticed by some member of the opposite sex. A regression to a more juvenile level. Fantasy formation. This is that a person believes themselves to be someone else. People who read novels or who watch a lot of television or read comics are very likely to have fantasies. Fantasies and daydreaming and autistic behavior, these are all a withdrawal from reality and living in a fantasy world. And it is well known by psychologists and psychiatrists that if a person lives in a fantasy world too much of the time, then they are quite likely to eventually get to the place where they cannot live in the real world anymore. Another mechanism is that of compensation. The Southerner has this when he intensely defends his homeland with a great deal of patriotism because of a sense of a knowledge that people in other sections of the country may consider the South to be a little backward, maybe. And so they intensely defend it and become overly patriotic. We can do that in a number of ways. Compensation is the name of that psychological adjustment area. Now you can see that some of these are not just adjustments, they are maladjustments. If we engage in them, they make us maladjusted. Now there are some mechanisms, some principles of mental development that can make us well adjusted. Let's just discuss some of these. Let's take the first one. These are principles for good adjustment of the personality. This is the adjusted personality. Number one is tact. Tact. Tact is the skill and ability to say and do the right thing at the right time. It's skill in dealing with people. It's the ability to handle difficult situations. It is the very essence of all right faith to do the right thing at the right time. That's tact. You will find that in volume 6, page 24, paragraph 3. The minister must not feel that the whole truth is to be spoken to unbelievers on any and every occasion. He should study carefully when to speak, what to say, and what to leave unsaid. Who is the finest example ever given to mankind on that subject? Jesus Christ was. He is the epitome of tact, knowing just what to say at the right time, how much to say. Now, generally speaking, most of us, I think, say too little. It would have been better if we had said more than we did say. Most of us want to conceal the fact that we are Christians, especially around non-Christians. We are afraid that they will criticize us, and so we may even compensate by appearing more worldly than we actually are, or to like things that are worldly more than we do, because of the fact that we do not wish to be thought of as being pious. I would like to encourage everybody to try to cultivate piety. And do not be ashamed that you are pious. Do not be ashamed to pray over your meals in public. Especially, do not be ashamed to pray in groups in a Christian society. That would certainly be a very good activity that we can do. Now, another principle of mental development is that of reason. Reason is a left hemisphere function. Now, the left hemisphere is trained mainly after the level of what age? 8 or 10, that's right. We can begin to train the left hemisphere at those ages, which means then that it would be well if we start training reason after about that age. But before a child can reason, the child can be trained to obey. Before a child can reason, the child can be trained to have faith in God. These are right hemisphere functions. And so we need to develop those while we're waiting for the time to begin to develop reason. Now in Isaiah 1:8, we read this, "Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord." In Job 13:3, "Surely I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God." In Jeremiah 12:1, the marginal reading is, "Righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with thee. Yet let me reason the case with thee. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are all they happy that deal very treacherously?" Reason, reasoning with God. Now there is a right and a wrong use of the reason. The powers of reasoning can be used properly to determine how it is that God has said what he has said. It is never used properly. Reason is never used properly when it is used to try to determine if God is correct. When God has spoken, we should believe it whether we can reason it out or not. If we do not understand it, we are still to believe it. This should be the attitude of the soul always. Whatever God has said, that we will do. Now, our reasoning powers have been given to us for use, and God desires us to exercise them. And I feel that we should exercise them daily. If we depend on the reasoning powers of others, the time will come sooner or later when we're going to be misled. So now is the time for us to develop our powers of reasoning. It was this thing that we were talking about when we were considering the proper training of the mind in such things as bookkeeping and accounting. Although we should train reason, we should exercise it, we should recognize that there is something that is higher than man's reason. Heart and intellect must bow to the great I Am. And when we understand that, our reasoning powers can then be put to a true use. It is a false use of reasoning to put them to the use of trying to determine if God is correct. And here I'd like to make a comment about current educational practices in schools. It is a wrong use of reasoning powers to train a child to rule on God's activities. When God has done something, a child should not be led to consider whether God was correct in doing that or not. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And do you know that it is quite widespread in schools of our day? This is a wrong use of reason. Yes. When Adam and Eve sinned, God evicted them from the Garden of Eden. Was God correct in doing that? That kind of question is a kind of question that can be used in teaching Bible in our day. All right. What I'm saying is this, that whatever God does, we should consider that it is correct. We should not train children to evaluate what God has done as to whether it was right or wrong. A correct use of reason is not to determine whether or not God did what was right. A correct use of wisdom, of reason, is to determine how it was that God was correct. God was correct in sending Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden because out in the world, they could meet with trials and temptations that would train their character, a thing that could not now be done so well in perfect Eden. Do you see the illustration there? All right. In this way, we train the child to understand the right use of reason. Now, there is much that could be said about the correct use of reason. Let me just read this from a book called Our High Calling, page 87. It is for you to hold every emotion and passion under control in calm subjection to reason and conscience. Then Satan loses his power to control the mind. Now let me just read that again. It is for you to hold every emotion and passion under control in calm subjection to reason and conscience. So what is it that should control the activities of a man? Reason and conscience. Those two things. Calm subjection. So we take a look at the table and we think, I could eat three more pieces of that or this. But we've already had a sufficiency. Calm subjection to reason and conscience. No anxiety about the matter at all. Simply calmly say no. Do you understand how that works? Subjection to reason. Passions and emotions. Every emotion, every passion in calm subjection to reason and conscience. Now, the next mechanism for good adjustment of the personality. Judgment. Our High Calling page number is 87. Judgment is the next one. Judgment is one of the higher faculties of the mind. Judgment is a left hemisphere function. It is a trained function. We learn things that can give us good judgment. Now, there are some people who seem to just naturally have good judgment. They can look at a situation and make a good judgment on that particular thing.
Is that a trained faculty?
Yes. Judgment is a trained faculty of the mind. But some people have a better capability for it. Maybe it's inborn in them. Judgment assists us to determine what is right or what is wrong in a case, in a certain case. All the powers of the mind should be exercised. All the faculties cultivated, perception, judgment, memory, and all the reasoning powers should have equal strength in order that minds may be well balanced. Now sit down and evaluate yourself. What things am I weak on? Am I weak on perception, on judgment, on memory, on reasoning powers, on accounting? What faculties of the mind have I failed to cultivate? Am I not outgoing in personality? Am I shy and retiring? Am I overly pushy in my social relationships? Over and over and over, we should evaluate ourselves and come to the position of determining whether or not we have a balance in the building of our characters and in the building of our personalities. Next. No, that one was volume 3, page 33. Next is discernment. Discernment also is a left hemisphere function. This function helps us to decide between a variety of things that are possible and to choose that is best. God wants us to have perfect discernment. He wants us to have a godly discernment. To discern is to perceive, to see clearly, to recognize. 1 Kings 3:9. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. Who said that? That was Solomon speaking. In Ezekiel 44 verse 23, we read, And the priests shall teach my people the difference between the holy and profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. How is discernment made then? By being taught. The priests would teach the people to discern. So it is a left hemisphere function in this way. It's something that is taught by the teachers. 1 Corinthians 12:10, for to one is given by the Spirit discerning of spirits. 1 Corinthians 12:10. Familiar acquaintance with the scriptures sharpens the discerning powers. We've already discussed the fact that if a person has an injury or a surgical procedure on the brain, a good way to build the brain's powers is that of memorizing the scriptures and becoming familiar with the scriptures. Now, even if you have not had an injury to the brain, if you're just an adult wanting to develop the mental powers, then what one should do is to make certain that one becomes acquainted with the scriptures. God requires the training of the mental faculties. He designs that his servants shall possess more intelligence and clearer discernment than the worldling. And he is displeased with those who are too careless or too indolent to become efficient, well-informed workers. Now here, I would like to say a word about the southern lady, or the clinging vine type of lady. It has come to be regarded in many circles as being a sign of femininity to be sort of a butterfly type, one who really does not have too much in the way of knowledge about anything. To give you an example, maybe one might say, oh, I can't do gardening. I don't know anything about it. And to say that in a sort of a babyish way, this is very feminine, apparently very appealing in the southern lady. And maybe people who are not so, maybe ladies who are not so southern. Considered appealing. To me, it is a sign of deficiency. A lady should be like a queen. A queen is a person who has enormous abilities. Abilities in many areas. A queen should be a person who is enjoyed by all, able to bless all, capable of pulling from her storehouse things old and things new to bless people with. She is constantly learning new things in order that she might be a blessing. Seventh-day Adventists have known for over 100 years that it would be well for women to learn. In the days that we first began teaching about this, it was learn how to harness and drive a horse with a buggy and so forth. Well, we no longer have buggies and horses, but the principle is exactly the same today, isn't it? If a woman intends to be a queen, one who can bless and counsel and help others, she must learn to do something with a car, at least learn to drive, and a few little things about how to take care of the car. I wouldn't think it amiss at all for a queen to know how to change a tire on a car, and how to jack it up and do all manner of things of this nature. It will greatly improve her usefulness if she knows these things. These are queenly virtues to me. There is nothing at all desirable about the young lady who flits around with not very much to recommend her usefulness. You folks need to pray for me on that I will be what God would like for me to be. Now let's take a look here at some principles, true and false, that can help us to recognize some things in ourselves, some mechanisms in ourselves that we may think are the real thing, but they are actually not. Let's take a look at a list of true things, such as faith, the false being presumption, dignity, the false being sophistication. Do you understand the difference in these terms? True healing as compared to a false system of healing. What is the true system of healing? God's methods, the remedies of nature. In fact, there are three parts to the definition of true healing. One is, yes, I'm sorry, it's not in good focus. One thing in the matter of true healing is that the true physician uses the remedies that nature provides. Number two, puts the principles of health reform into the life of the patient and also exhibits these in the life himself. And the third thing is the faith in the great physician. Not that that is smallest. And from the study that we have already had on endorphins and enkephalins and opioids, you will recognize that that faith in the great physician is one of the greatest healing agencies that we can have. We should exploit this healing agency more for the benefit of the patient as well as for the spread of the gospel. Law-abiding as compared to legalism. Legalism is doing a law for the hope of reward. Law-abiding is obeying the law because the law itself is loved. The psalmist says, "And on thy law I meditate day and night." Do you remember that? Because the law is delightful to meditate on. Having spent my lifetime in learning the laws that deal with healing, it is my joy to study these laws, as well as the laws of God that have to do with morality. Take the difference between the true Sabbath rest and that of simply ceasing from work. There is a difference. There is a difference. We need to recognize true Sabbath observance and avoid simple work cessation. Surrender as compared to resignation. Surrender to God is an active thing. It is a love relationship. It is an exchange, an entering into a relationship in surrender. Not a resignation. Here I am, do to me what you wish. I know that it's not going to be good, but I will just resign myself to my fate. That's the false. Did you know that you could pray to God or pray to Satan? And that there is a difference between the two? In the day that we live in, prayer to Satan is far more common than prayer to God, even amongst Christians. All right. How can we know when we are praying to God or praying to Satan in our day? And we are Christians and we really would like to be praying to God, but we're actually praying to Satan. And Satan is presiding over our religious experience. Well, let me just, to give you an illustration, let's go back to the time of the cross. You remember at the time of the cross, if people continued to engage in the old ceremonial system, Satan was presiding over their religious experience. Do you accept that? If not, let me go over it again. Can you accept that just by my simply stating it? Is there anybody who does not understand that? Let me just say that again. At the time of the cross, after that, if a person continued in such things as circumcision and the celebration of the ceremonial system in the same old way, if one engaged in that, who was in charge of his religious experience? Was it God? Indeed not. It was then Satan. Satan became the one who presided over the religious experience of those who engaged in that kind of thing. today it is exactly the same thing. If we have not recognized that we have passed into a new experience in our relationship, and we are still in the same old way that we were, then Satan is presiding over our experience, and our prayers will be to Satan and not to God. Now the next thing is God's providence as compared to the devil's trap. Now let me give you an illustration here. People will sometimes say to me, well, we started to have a revival in our church, but God closed all the doors to it, and so we just abandoned it. What do you think about that kind of thing? In the days of Jonah went down to Joppa. You remember? What was waiting? What did the Lord have waiting for Jonah down there in Joppa? And so, because the boat was waiting, Jonah thought the Lord had provided that, didn't he? Probably. And so he got on the boat. Do you see how this kind of thing can work for us? We can take any manner of thing that we want to have happen and say that the Lord had that to happen, just as in Jonah's case. The Lord didn't have anything to do with the provision of the boat. Satan had that boat waiting there for Jonah, didn't he? But Jonah could very easily have said that it was the Lord's provision for him. We need to recognize that the devil can have a trap for us. And I have heard the most strange stories in my experience as a physician, people telling me what the Lord had provided when I knew very well it had not been provided by the Lord at all. True charity as compared to Thanksgiving baskets. Righteous indignation as compared to impatience or anger. Hunger, perverted appetite. Cheerfulness compared to levity. Joyous laughter as compared to nervous or anxious laughter. True love compared to sentimentalism. These are all psychological principles that we need to be able to recognize the true as compared to the false. Yes?
I think Dr. Thrash, in that crisis, warned us that in the last days that almost even the very elect will be deceived.
Yes.
Myself, I never realized how much that I had been taught I had been deceived. And so I found that one of the things that has been the most helpful to me personally is to ask myself some questions. First of all, if what I believe is the truth, then what is the counterfeit?
Mm-hmm.
And if I couldn't name the counterfeit, I probably was believing the counterfeit.
Well, that's a good statement.
That's one thing that has really twisted my head around where I needed to be twisted.
All right, let me restate that so that everybody can hear. If what I believe, I cannot recognize a counterfeit, then I probably am believing the counterfeit rather than the truth. That certainly would be a thing to help us evaluate our doctrines, wouldn't it? We should take a look at our doctrines, see just what they are, see what we believe on everything. What do I believe about how I should attend church? Must I be at church all the time? What is the truth? Well, the Bible tells us, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. If I believe that I should go out and spend my Sabbaths under a tree, I may be believing a counterfeit. So do you see how that kind of thing works? I thought that was a very good thing. Yes?
A second one, especially for new believers, is I should do generally what is right is the opposite of what I would want to do.
Natural inclination is usually the opposite of what would be the right thing to do. Until we get a good Christian experience, that is the case. That we generally have been taught in a world bent to entertaining itself and amusing itself. We have generally been taught to do that is wrong rather than that is right. And it becomes the inclination to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing. Now, a word about laughter. This one right here, joyous laughter. There are some whose Christian experience is of such a nature that they feel that any time there is laughter, that it is of a worldly, wrong thing. There are some people who cannot laugh. Some people who go through a sickness will tell you that for weeks or months after the experience of their sickness, they could not laugh. It was a part of their sickness that they could not laugh. Who is it who gives us the ability to laugh? It is a very special thing to laugh. Many animals do not laugh. There are very, very, very few who laugh. But human beings can laugh. But there are certain subjects that we can properly laugh about. And some time ago, I wrote this little paragraph on laughter, and I would like to read it to you. The experience of mirthful laughter is a God-given experience and should not be denied, providing the laughter is about acceptable subjects. There are certain subjects that should be carefully guarded, and no laughter concerning those subjects permitted. Such matters as funny stories which are made up or produced for no other purpose than to give a laugh to the individual, or to aggrandize the person telling the story, or belittle some other individual or institution, those should not be allowed. Witticisms that are made for the purpose of stimulating a laugh should be carefully avoided, particularly in the sacred desk. Now, there, in the South, we have a thing that we call the tickle box. Have you ever heard of that? And some people's tickle box gets turned over much more easily than others. They tell me that the British people, just they hardly even have a tickle box. If they do have one, it almost never gets turned over. But for people who grow up in the South, their tickle boxes turn over very easily, and so they laugh at a lot of things. Therefore, it is the responsibility of others who are responsible around them not to stimulate them to turn over the tickle box, or they will be laughing all the time. I feel that we should take a responsible position toward our fellow man and not tell those witticisms that may make the other person have an abandonment of spirituality and have their spirituality go down low. Now, the person who is joking, especially in the sacred desk, may be able to change from the witticism to something that is sacred in just the bat of an eyelid. But there are many who cannot do that. Therefore, those of us who stand in the sacred desk must have it as a responsible thing that we will not be engaging in witticisms always or those kinds of things that will just bring a laugh in order to make ourselves look better or to make someone else get the tickle box turned over.
Sometimes, yes. Especially in my situation, I've gone through a time where I hardly laughed at all.
Yes.
I see something in nature, like a bird chopping down my cat's head or something, and it gets me laughing, and then the more I close my eyes, I can see it all over again. It's just funny and funny and funny.
I'm so glad you brought that up. One of the legitimate subjects about which we can laugh is nature. We may also laugh at predicaments that we get into. That's perfectly fine for us to laugh at those things. The wheel falls off into the ditch and you're in a predicament. It is quite proper to laugh about that kind of thing. It is quite proper to laugh about the antics of children, provided the children are unaware that you're laughing at them. If you laugh at a child and they know that you're laughing about them, they become clowns because they understand that it has been nice for you to laugh and they want to make certain that you continue laughing. Yes, that's a predicament type of thing. Yes, laughing at oneself is the sort of predicament type of laughing at the predicaments that we can get into. To make certain that we don't get into, gloominess over our our problems. Now let's take another matter, and that is wisdom's temple. You remember the subject of wisdom's temple in the Bible? Proverbs 9:1, wisdom hath builded her house, she hath hewn out her seven pillars. Dear Brother McClure, he and Sister McClure were the first deans of our educational work here, and Sister McClure has retired three times and is still working. Today she's still working and teaching, and still carrying on an active role in the leadership here at UC Pines. In studying this matter of wisdom's seven pillars, Brother and Sister McClure made what they called wisdom's temple, and here it is. And as they were looking through the scriptures, they believed that they should be able to find seven principles that would make up wisdom's temple. And here they are. These are the seven. Beholding or faith. Now you'll find that in 2 Corinthians 3:18. But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. Now this is the principle of beholding. This is one of the principles of true education. That's wisdom's temple. Wisdom's temple is true education. Now the next of the of wisdom's pillars is that of love. Now you will find in 1 John 4 verses 8 and 16, you will find the thought, God is love. You will also find in Matthew 22, verses 37 to 40, God's law is love. In fact, as you study the law, you will find that the Bible says exactly the same thing about law that it says about the character of God. Here it says, God's law is love. But in 1 John 4, 8, and 16, we find that God is love. We find that the law is righteousness. God is righteousness. The law is powerful. God is powerful. The law is eternal. God is eternal. The law is a transcript of the character of God. And here, this great law in the principle of true education, the law of love, that is one of the pillars that makes up wisdom's temple in true education. Now the third one is the great law of cooperation. In our day, cooperation has been largely supplanted by competition. But it is not God's will that we should train our children into habits of competition. We should train our children into habits of cooperation. 1 Corinthians 3:9, where we read about the cooperation that God wants us to have. All through the Bible, the great principle of cooperation holds forth, as in Genesis 1, verses 2 and 3, where we read that, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep, and God said. When God spake, which member of the Godhead was it who spake? It was Christ who spoke, but the Spirit of God was also operative in the creation of the world. This godly principle of cooperation can become ours and our children's if we're willing. The next of wisdom's pillars is that of obedience. In Jeremiah 7:23 and John 14:15, we find these great laws brought out. Jeremiah 7:23 is, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and ye shall be my people, and walk ye in all the ways I have commanded you, that it may be well unto you. Now in the New Testament, we find the same thing in John 14, verse 15, where Jesus said, If you love me, keep my commandments, and my friends do what I have commanded them to do. This is Jesus' word to us in the New Testament. Now the next of wisdom's pillars, these are principles of true education, is the great principle of simplicity. Our meals should be simple. Our dress, simple. Our homes, simple. Our lives, simple. The great principle of simplicity is mentioned in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 3. But I fear lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. And as you study the whole of the Christian religion, one theme goes throughout the entire Christian religion, and that is the theme of simplicity. You will find it everywhere. Yes?
And I would say simplicity goes with economy.
Yes. Good point. Simplicity goes with economy. The next of wisdom's pillars is that of utility or usefulness. John 5, verse 17, and Mark 6, verse 3. Utility, or being useful, is the same thing that we were just talking about with the woman who was a queen rather than a butterfly. John 5, verse 17 says, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work." What kind of occupation would, if you were going to put a name on the occupation of God, what is the only name that you really know for the occupation of God? Farmer or gardener. That's the only thing that we really know, isn't it? We know that he planted a garden eastward in Eden, and that's so far as we know. That's his occupation. He may be a lot of other things as well. My father was a businessman. He was the sheriff in our county for almost 20 years. He had a lot of other irons in the fire. But if you asked him what his occupation was, he always said he was a farmer. He had been a dairyman for a number of years. That's where I grew up, was on my father's dairy farm. But my father left the farm, but he never stopped being a farmer. As long as he lived, he always considered that that's what he was. Our Savior, in his human form, was a carpenter. And I know a man who always calls himself a carpenter. He had the same sort of experience that my father did, that he was a carpenter early in his life and then went into business and politics and... But he always called himself a carpenter. If you asked him what he was a carpenter. Utility is that important thing. In John 1, verses 1 to 3, Jesus, the Word, worked with the Father in the creation of all things. And you will find, as you read the Scriptures, how it is that the great worthies in heaven are useful. Now the last of the seven pillars is that of service. Matthew 20 and verse 28, verses 25 to 28. Whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. The Son of Man came to minister and to give his life. Luke 22 verse 27, I am among you as he that serveth. This should be our attitude. Not that we have come here to be served by others. Now, I have been reading to you from a book called The Principles of True Education. This is a book that can be made available. If anyone would like to have some of these, they can be made available. There may be some of these in the New Lifestyle Books office. Don't think there is. Sister McClure says there. All right, on service, Matthew 20 and verse 28. And also Luke 22 and verse 27. All right, these are the Principles of True Education.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra with outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.